They crossed the lobby and waited for the elevator. Priest imagined Kincaid coming after him, gun drawn, saying, "What kind of attorney can't write his own goddamn name, asshole?" But the elevator came, and they rode down and walked out of the building into the fresh air. Flowers said, "I gotta have the craziest dad in the world." Priest smiled at her. "That's the truth." "Why did we have false names?" "Well, I never liked the pigs to get my real name," he said. She would accept that, he thought. She knew how her parents felt about cops. But she said, "Well, I'm mad at you about it." He frowned. "Why?" "I'll never forgive you for calling me Florence," she said. Priest stared at her for a moment, then they both burst out laughing. "Come on, kid," Priest said fondly. "Let's go home." Chapter 10 Judy dreamed she walked along the seashore with Michael Quirkus, and his bare feet left neat, shapely prints in the wet sand. On Saturday morning, she helped out at a literacy class for young offenders. They respected her because she carried a gun. She sat in a church hall beside a 17-year-old hoodlum, helping him practice writing the date, hoping that somehow this would make it less likely that in 10 years' time she would have to arrest him. In the afternoon, she drove the short distance from Beau's house to Gala Foods on Geary Boulevard and shopped. The familiar Saturday routines failed to soothe her. She was furious with Brian Kincaid for taking her off the Hammer of Eden case, but there was nothing she could do about it, so she stomped up and down the aisles and tried to turn her mind to Chewy Chips Ahoy, Rice-A-Roni, and Z Decor Collection kitchen towel printed with yellow patterns. In the breakfast cereal aisle, she thought of Michael's son, Dusty, and she bought a box of Cap'n Crunch. But her thoughts kept returning to the case. Is there really someone out there who can make earthquakes happen, or am I nuts? Back at home, Beau helped her unload the groceries and asked her about the investigation. "I hear Marvin Hayes raided the Green California campaign." "It can't have done him much good," she said. "They're all clean. Roger interviewed them on Tuesday. 2 men and 3 women, all over 50. No criminal records, not a speeding ticket between them, and no association with any suspicious persons. If they're terrorists, I'm Kojak." "TV News says he's examining their records." "Right, that's a list of everyone who ever wrote asking them for information, including Jane Fonda. There are 18,000 names and addresses. Now Marvin's team has to run each name through the FBI computer to see who's worth interviewing. It could take a month." The doorbell rang. Judy opened the door to Simon Sparrow. She was surprised, but pleased. "Hey, Simon, come on in." He was wearing black cycling shorts and a muscle T-shirt with Nike trainers and wraparound sunglasses. However, he had not come by bicycle. His emerald-green Honda del Sol was parked at the curb with the roof down. Judy wondered what her mother would have thought of Simon. "Nice boy," she might have said. "Not very manly, though." Beau shook hands with Simon, then gave Judy a clandestine look that said, "Who the hell is this brute?" Judy shocked him by saying, "Simon is one of the FBI's top linguistic analysts." Somewhat bemused, Beau said, "Well, Simon, I'm sure glad to meet you." Simon was carrying a cassette tape and a manila envelope. Holding them up, he said, "I brought you my report on the Hammer of Eden tape." "I'm off the case," Judy said. "I know, but I thought you'd still be interested. The voices on the tape don't match any in our acoustic files, unfortunately."
"No names, then?"
"No, but lots of other interesting stuff."
Judy's interest was piqued.
"You said voices. I only heard one."
"No, there are two."
Simon looked around and saw Beau's radio cassette on the kitchen counter. It was normally used to play the greatest hits of the Everly Brothers. He slipped his cassette into the player.
"Let me talk you through the tape."
"I'd love you to, but it's Marvin Hayes' case now."
"I'd like your opinion anyway."
Judy shook her head stubbornly.
"You should talk to Marvin first."
"I know what you're saying, but Marvin is a fucking idiot. Do you know how long it is since he put a bad guy in jail?"
"Simon, if you're trying to get me to work on this case behind Kincaid's back, forget it."
"Hear me out, okay? It can't do any harm."
Simon turned up the volume control and started the tape. Judy sighed. She was desperately keen to know what Simon had found out about the Hammer of Eden. But if Kincaid learned that Simon had talked to her before Marvin, there would be hell to pay. The voice of the woman said, "This is the Hammer of Eden with a message for Governor Mike Robeson." Simon stopped the tape and looked at Beau. "What did you visualize when you first heard that?" Beau grinned. "I pictured a large woman, about 50, with a big smile. Kind of sexy. I remember I thought I'd like to..." He glanced at Judy and finished. "Meet her." Simon nodded. "Your instincts are reliable. Untrained people can tell a lot about a speaker just by hearing them. You almost always know if you're listening to a woman or a man, of course, but you can also tell how old they are, and you can generally estimate their height and build pretty accurately. Sometimes you can even guess at their state of health." "You're right," Judy said. She was intrigued, despite herself. "Whenever I hear a voice on the phone, I picture the person, even if I'm listening to a taped announcement." "It's because the sound of the voice comes from the body. Pitch, loudness, resonance, huskiness, all vocal characteristics have physical causes. Tall people have a longer vocal tract. Old people have stiff tissues and creaky cartilage. Sick people have inflamed throats." "That makes sense," Judy said. "I just never really thought about it before." "My computer picks up the same cues as people do and is more accurate." Simon took a typed report out of the envelope he had been carrying. "This woman is between 47 and 52. She's tall, within an inch of 6 feet. She's overweight but not obese, probably just kind of generously built. She's a drinker and a smoker, but healthy despite that." Judy felt anxious but excited. Although she wished she had not let Simon get started, it was fascinating to learn something about the mystery woman behind the voice. Simon looked at Beau. "And you're right about the big smile. She has a large mouth cavity, and her speech is underlabialized. She doesn't purse her lips." "I like this woman," Beau said. "Does the computer say if she's good in bed?" Simon smiled. "The reason you think she's sexy is that her voice has a whispery quality. This can be a sign of sexual arousal, but when it's a permanent feature, it doesn't necessarily indicate sexiness." "I think you're wrong," Beau said. "Sexy women have sexy voices." "So do heavy smokers." "Okay, that's true." Simon wound the tape back to the beginning. "Now, listen to her accent." Judy protested. "Simon, I don't think we should just listen, please." "Okay, okay." This time he played the first two sentences. "This is the Hammer of Eden with a message for Governor Mike Robeson." Shit, I didn't expect to be talking to a tape recorder. He stopped the tape. "It's a Northern California accent, of course, but did you notice anything else?" Beau said, "She's middle class." Judy frowned. "She sounded upper class to me." "You're both right," Simon said. "Her accent changes between the first sentence and the second." "Is that unusual?" said Judy. "No. Most of us get our basic accent from the social group we grew up with, then modify it later in life. Usually people try to upgrade. Blue-collar people try to make themselves sound more affluent, and the nouveau riche try to talk like old money. Occasionally it goes the other way. A politician from a patrician family might make his accent more down-home, to seem like a man of the people. You know what I'm saying?" Judy smiled. "You bet your ass." "The learned accent is used in formal situations," Simon said as he rewound the tape. "It comes into play when the speaker is poised, but we revert to our childhood speech patterns when we're under stress. Okay so far?" Beau said, "Sure." "This woman has downgraded her speech. She makes herself sound more blue-collar than she really is." Judy was fascinated. "You think she's a kind of Patty Hearst figure?" "In that area, yes. She begins with a rehearsed formal sentence, spoken in her average person voice. Now, in American speech, the more high class you are, the more you pronounce the letter R. With that in mind, listen to the way she says the word governor now." Judy was going to stop him, but she was too interested. The woman on the tape said,
This is the Hammer of Eden with a message for Governor Mike Robeson.
Hear the way she says, Governor Mike? This is street talk, but listen to the next bit. The voicemail announcement has put her off guard, and she speaks naturally.
Shit, I didn't expect to be talking to a tape recorder.
Although she says shit, she pronounces the word recorder very correctly. A blue-collar type would say recorder, pronouncing only the first R. The average college student says recorder, pronouncing the second R distinctly. Only very superior people say recorder the way she does, carefully pronouncing all three R's.
Bo said, Who'd have thought you could find out so much from two sentences?
Simon smiled, looking pleased. But did you notice anything about the vocabulary?
Bo shook his head.
Nothing I can put my finger on.
What's a tape recorder?
Bo laughed. A machine the size of a small suitcase with two reels on top. I had one in Vietnam, a Grundig. Judy saw what Simon was getting at. The term tape recorder was out of date. The machine they were using today was a cassette deck. Voicemail was recorded on the hard disk of a computer.
She's living in a time warp, Judy said. It makes me think Patty Hearst again. What happened to her anyway?
Bo said, She served her time, came out of jail, wrote a book, and appeared on Geraldo. Welcome to America.
Judy stood up. This has been fascinating, Simon, but I don't feel comfortable with it. I think you should take your report to Marvin now.
One more thing I want to show you, he said. He touched the fast-forward button.
Really, just listen to this.
The woman's voice said, It happened in Owens Valley, a little after 2 o'clock. You can check it out. There was a faint background noise, and she hesitated. Simon paused the tape.
I've enhanced that odd little murmur. Here it is reconstructed.
He released the pause switch. Judy heard a man's voice, distorted with a lot of background hiss, but clear enough to understand, say, We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government. The background noise returned to normal, and the woman's voice repeated, We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government. She went on. Now that you know we can do what we say, you'd better think again about our demand.
Simon stopped the tape.
Judy said, She was speaking words he had given her, and she forgot something, so he reminded her.
Bo said, Didn't you figure the original internet message had been dictated by a blue-collar guy, maybe illiterate, and typed by an educated woman?
Yes, Simon said, but this is a different woman, older.
So, Bo said to Judy, now you're beginning to build up profiles of three unknown subjects.
No, I'm not, she said. I'm off the case. Come on, Simon, you know this could get me into more trouble.
Okay.
He took the tape out of the machine and stood up. I've told you all the important stuff anyway. Let me know if you come up with some brilliant insight that I could pass on to Mogadon Marvin.
Judy saw him to the door.
I'll take my report to the office right now. Marvin will probably still be there, he said. Then I'm going to sleep. I was up all night on this.
He got into his sports car and roared off.
When she came back, Bo was making green tea, looking thoughtful.
So this streetwise guy has a bunch of classy dames to take dictation from him.
Judy nodded.
I believe I know where you're headed.
It's a cult.
Yes, I was right to think Patty Hearst.
She shivered. The man behind all this must be a charismatic figure with power over women. He was uneducated, but this did not hold him back, for he had others carrying out his orders.
But something's not right. That demand for a freeze on new power plants, it's just not wacky enough.
I agree, Bo said. It's not showy. I think they have some down-to-earth selfish reason to want this freeze.
I wonder, Judy mused, maybe they have an interest in one particular power plant.
Bo stared at her.
Judy, that's brilliant. Like it's going to pollute their salmon river or something.
In there somewhere, she said, but it hits them really hard. She felt excited. She was onto something. The freeze on all plant construction is a cover, then. They're afraid to name the one they're really interested in for fear that would lead us to them.
But how many possibilities can there be? Power plants aren't built every day, and these things are controversial. Any proposal has to have been reported.
Let's check.
They went into the den. Judy's laptop was on a side table. She sometimes wrote reports in here while Beau was watching football. The TV did not distract her, and she liked to be near him. She switched on the machine. Waiting for it to boot up, she said, "If we put together a list of sites where power plants are to be built, the FBI computer would tell us if there's a cult near any of them."
She accessed the files of the San Francisco Chronicle and searched for references to power plants in the last 3 years. The search produced 117 articles. Judy scanned the headlines, ignoring stories about Pittsburgh and Cuba.
"Okay, here's a scheme for a nuclear plant in the Mojave Desert."
She saved the story.
"A hydroelectric dam in Sierra County, an oil-fired plant up near the Oregon border."
Beau said, "Sierra County? That rings some kind of bell. Got an exact location?"
Judy clicked on the article.
"Yeah, the proposal is to dam the Silver River."
He frowned.
"Silver River Valley?"
Judy turned from the computer screen.
"Wait, this is familiar. Isn't there a vigilante group that has a big spread there?"
"That's right," said Beau.
"They're called Los Alamos, run by a speed freak called Poco Latella, who originally came from Daly City. That's how I know about them."
"Right. They're armed to the teeth, and they refuse to recognize the U.S. government."
"Jesus, they even used that sentence on the tape. We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government."
"Beau, I think we've got them."
"What are you going to do?"
Judy's heart sank as she remembered she was off the case.
"If Kincaid finds out I've been working this case, he'll bust a gut."
"Los Alamos has to be checked out."
"I'll call Simon." She picked up the phone and dialed the office. The switchboard operator was a guy she knew.
"Hey, Charlie, this is Judy. Is Simon Sparrow in the office?"
"He came and went," Charlie said. "Want me to try his car?"
"Yeah, thanks."
She waited. Charlie came back on the line and said, "No answer. I tried his home number, too. Shall I put a message on his pager?"
"Yes, please."
Judy recalled that he had said he was going to sleep.
"I bet he's turned it off, though."
"I'll send him a message to call you."
"Thanks."
She hung up and said to Beau, "I think I have to see Kincaid. I guess if I give him a hot lead, he can't be too mad at me."
Beau just shrugged. "You don't have any choice, do you?"
Judy could not risk people getting killed just because she was afraid to confess what she had been doing.
"No, I don't have any choice," she said.
She was wearing narrow black jeans and a strawberry pink T-shirt. The T-shirt was too figure-hugging for the office, even on a Saturday. She went up to her room and changed it for a loose white polo shirt. Then she got in her Monte Carlo and drove downtown. Marvin would have to organize a raid on Los Alamos. There might be trouble. Vigilantes were crazy. The raid needed to be heavily manned and meticulously organized. The Bureau was terrified of another Waco. Every agent in the office would be drafted in for it. The Sacramento field office of the FBI would also be involved. They would probably strike at dawn tomorrow. She went straight to Kincaid's office. His secretary was in the outer room, working at her computer, wearing a Saturday outfit of white jeans and a red shirt. She picked up the phone and said, "Judy Maddox is here to see you." After a moment, she hung up and said to Judy, "Go right in." Judy hesitated at the door to the inner sanctum. The last two times she had entered this office, she had suffered humiliation and disappointment inside. But she was not superstitious. Maybe this time Kincaid would be understanding and gracious. It still jarred her to see his beefy figure in the chair that used to belong to the slight, dapper Milton Lestrange. She had not yet visited Milton the hospital, she realized. She made a mental note to go tonight or tomorrow. Brian's greeting was chilly.
"What can I do for you, Judy?"
"I saw Simon Sparrow earlier," she began. "He brought his report to me because he hadn't heard I was off the case. Naturally, I told him to give it to Marvin. Naturally. But he told me a little of what he had found, and I speculated that the Hammer of Eden is a cult that feels somehow threatened by a planned building project for a power plant. Brian looked annoyed. "I'll pass this on to Marvin," he said impatiently. Judy plowed on. "There are several power plant projects in California right now, I checked, and one of them is in Silver River Valley, where there is a right-wing vigilante group called Los Alamos. Brian, I think Los Alamos must be the Hammer of Eden. I think we should raid them."
"Is that what you think?" "Oh, shit."
"Is there a flaw in my logic?" she said icily.
"You bet there is." He stood up. "The flaw is you're not on the goddamn case."
"I know," she said, "but I thought..."
He interrupted her, stretching his arm across the big desk and pointing an accusing finger at her face.
"You've intercepted the psycholinguistic report, and you're trying to sneak your way back on the case, and I know why. You think it's a high-profile case, and you're trying to get yourself noticed."
"Who by?" she said indignantly.
"FBI headquarters, the press, Governor Robeson."
"I am not."
"You just listen up. You are off this case. Do you understand me? O-F-F off. You don't talk to your friend Simon about it. You don't check power plant schemes. And you don't propose raids on vigilante hangouts."
"Jesus Christ.
This is what you do. You go home. And you leave this case to Marvin and me."
"Brian, goodbye, Judy. Have a nice weekend."
She stared at him. He was red-faced and breathing hard. She felt furious but helpless. She fought back the angry retorts that sprang to her lips. She had been forced to apologize for swearing at him once already, and she did not need that humiliation again. She bit her lip. After a long moment, she turned on her heel and walked out of the room. Chapter 11 Priest parked the old Plymouth Cuda at the side of the road in the faint light of early dawn. He took Melanie's hand and led her into the forest. The mountain air was cool, and they shivered in their T-shirts until the effort of walking warmed their bodies. After a few minutes, they emerged on a bluff that looked over the width of the Silver River Valley.
"This is where they want to build the dam," Priest said.
At this point, the valley narrowed to a bottleneck, so that the far side was no more than 400 or 500 yards away. It was still too dark to see the river, but in the morning silence they heard it rushing along below them. As the light strengthened, they could distinguish the dark shapes of cranes and giant earth-moving machines below them, silent and still, like sleeping dinosaurs. Priest had almost given up hope that Governor Robeson would now negotiate. This was the second day since the Owens Valley earthquake, and still there was no word. Priest could not figure out the governor's strategy, but it was not capitulation. There would have to be another earthquake. But he was anxious. Melanie and Star might be reluctant, especially as the second tremor would have to do more damage than the first. He had to firm up their commitment. He was starting with Melanie. "It'll create a lake 10 miles long, all the way up the valley," he told her. He could see her pale oval face become taut with anger. "Upstream from here, everything you see will be underwater." Beyond the bottleneck, there was a broad valley floor. As the landscape became visible, they could see a scatter of houses and some neat cultivated fields, all connected by dirt tracks. Melanie said, "Surely someone tried to stop the dam?" Priest nodded. "There was a big legal battle. We took no part. We don't believe in courts and lawyers. And we didn't want reporters and TV crews swarming all over our place. Too many of us have secrets to keep. That's why we don't even tell people we're a commune. Most of our neighbors don't know we exist, and the others think the vineyard is run from Napa and staffed by transient workers. So we didn't take part in the protest. But some of the wealthier residents hired lawyers, and the environmental group sided with the local people. It did no good."
"How come?"
"Governor Robeson backed the dam and put this guy Al Honeymoon on the case." Priest hated Honeymoon. He had lied and cheated and manipulated the press with total ruthlessness. "He got the whole thing turned around so that the media made folks here look like a handful of selfish types who wanted to deny electric power to every hospital and school in California."
Like it's your fault that people in Los Angeles put underwater lights in their pools and have electric motors to close their drapes.
Right. So Coastal Electric got permission to build the dam.
And all those people will lose their homes. Plus a pony trekking center, a wildlife camp, several summer cabins, and a crazy bunch of armed vigilantes known as Los Alamos.
Everyone gets compensation, except us, because we don't own our land. We rent it on a one-year lease. We get nothing for the best vineyard between Napa and Bordeaux.
And the only place I ever felt at peace.
Priest gave a murmur of sympathy. This was the way he wanted the conversation to go.
Has Dusty always had these allergies?
From birth. He was actually allergic to milk. Cow's milk, formula, even breast milk. He survived on goat's milk.
That was when I realized. The human race must be doing something wrong if the world is so polluted that my own breast milk is poisonous to my child.
But you took him to doctors.
Michael insisted. I knew they'd do no good. They gave us drugs that suppressed his immune system in order to inhibit the reaction to allergens.
What kind of a way is that to treat his condition? He needed pure water and clean air and a healthy way of life.
I guess I've been searching ever since he was born for a place like this.
It was hard for you.
You have no idea. A single woman with a sick kid can't hold down a job, can't get a decent apartment, can't live. You think America's a big place, but it's all the damn same.
You were in a bad way when I met you.
I was about to kill myself, and Dusty, too.
Tears came to her eyes.
Then you found this place.
Her face darkened with anger.
And now they want to take it away from me.
The FBI is saying we didn't cause the earthquake, and the governor hasn't said anything.
To hell with them. We'll have to do it again. Only this time, make sure they can't ignore it.
That was what he wanted her to say. It would have to cause real damage, bring down some buildings. People might get hurt.
But we have no choice.
We could leave the valley, break up the commune, go back to the old way of life. Regular jobs, money, poisoned air, greed, jealousy, and hate.
He had her frightened. No, she cried. Don't say that.
I guess you're right. We can't go back now.
I sure can't.
He took another look up and down the valley. We'll make certain it stays the way God made it.
She closed her eyes in relief and said, Amen.
He took her hand and led her through the trees back to the car.
Driving along the narrow road up the valley, Priest said, Are you going to pick up Dusty from San Francisco today?
Yeah, I'll leave after breakfast.
Priest heard a strange noise over the asthmatic throb of the ancient V8 engine. He glanced up out of the side window and saw a helicopter.
Shit, he said and stamped on the brake.
Melanie was thrown forward.
What is it? She said in a frightened voice.
Priest stopped the car and jumped out. The chopper was disappearing northward.
Melanie got out.
What's the matter?
What's a helicopter doing here?
Oh, my God, she said shakily. You think it's looking for us?
The noise faded, then came back. The chopper reappeared suddenly over the trees, flying low.
I think it's the feds, Priest said. Damn!
After yesterday's lackluster press conference, he had felt safe for a few more days. Kincaid and Hayes had seemed a long way from tracking him down. Now they were here in the valley.
Melanie said, What are we going to do?
Keep calm. They haven't come for us.
How do you know?
I made sure of it.
She became tearful. Priest, why do you keep talking in riddles?
I'm sorry.
He remembered that he needed her for what he had to do. That meant he had to explain things to her. He gathered his thoughts.
They can't be coming for us because they don't know about us. The commune doesn't appear on any government records. Our land is rented by Star. It's not on police or FBI files because we've never come to their attention. There's never been a newspaper article or TV program about us. We're not registered with the IRS. Our vineyard isn't on any map.
So why are they here?
I think they've come for Los Alamos. Those nutcases must be on file with every law enforcement agency in the continental United States.
For God's sake, they stand at their gate holding high-powered rifles just to make sure that everyone knows there's a bunch of dangerous frigging lunatics in there.
How can you be sure the FBI are after them?
I made certain of it. When Starr called the John Truth Show, I had her say the Los Alamos slogan, "We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government." I laid a false trail.
Are we safe, then?
Not quite. After they draw a blank at Los Alamos, the feds may take a look at the other people in the valley. They'll see the vineyard from the chopper and pay us a visit. So we'd better get home to warn the others.
He jumped into the car. As soon as Melanie was in, he floored the pedal. But the car was 25 years old and had not been designed for speed on winding mountain roads. He cursed its wheezy carburetors and lurching suspension. As he struggled to maintain speed on the twisting road, he wondered fretfully who at the FBI had ordered this raid. He had not expected Kincaid or Hayes to make the necessary intuitive jump. There had to be someone else on the case. He wondered who. A black car came up behind, going fast, headlights blazing, although it was past daybreak. They were approaching a bend, but the driver honked and pulled out the pass. As it went by, Priest saw the driver and his companion, two burly young men dressed in casual clothes, but clean-shaven and short-haired. Immediately afterward, a second car came up behind, honking and flashing.
"Fuck this," Priest said.
When the FBI was in a hurry, it was best to get out of the way. He braked and pulled over. The near-side wheels of the Cuda bumped over the roadside grass. The second car flashed by, and a third came up. Priest brought his car to a halt. He and Melanie sat and watched a stream of vehicles race past. As well as cars, there were two armored trucks and three minivans full of grim-faced men and a few women.
"It's a raid," Melanie said woefully.
"No fucking kidding," Priest said, the tension making him sarcastic. She did not seem to notice. Then a car peeled off from the convoy and pulled up right behind the Cuda. Priest was suddenly afraid. He stared at the car in his rearview mirror. It was a dark green Buick Regal. The driver was speaking into a phone. There was another man in the passenger seat. Priest could not make out their faces. He wished with all his heart that he had not gone to the press conference. One of the guys in the Buick might have been there yesterday. If so, he would be sure to ask what a lawyer from Oakland was doing in Silver River Valley. It could hardly be a coincidence. Any agent with half a brain would immediately put Priest at the top of the suspect list. The last of the convoy flashed by. In the Buick, the driver put down his phone. Any second now, the agents would get out of the car. Priest cast about desperately for a plausible story. "I got so interested in this case, and I remembered a TV show on this vigilante group and their slogan about not recognizing the government. The same thing the woman said on John Truth's answering machine, so I thought I would, you know, play detective and check them out myself." But they would not take his word for it. No matter how plausible his story, they would question him so thoroughly that he could not possibly fool them. The two agents got out of the car. Priest stared hard at them in his mirror. He did not recognize either one. He relaxed a little. There was a film of sweat on his face. He wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. Melanie said, "Oh, Jesus, what do they want?"
"Stay cool," Priest said. "Don't seem like you want to hurry away.
I'm going to pretend I'm real, real interested in them. That'll make them want to get rid of us as fast as they can. Reverse psychology." He jumped out of the car.
"Hey, are you the police?" he said enthusiastically. "Is there something big going down?"
The driver, a thin man with black-framed glasses, said, "We're federal agents. Sir, we checked your plates, and your car is registered to the Napa Bottling Company." Paul Beale took care of getting the car insured and smogged and other paperwork.
"That's my employer."
"May I see your driver's license?"
"Oh, sure."
Priest took the license out of his back pocket.
"Was that your chopper I saw?"
"Yes, sir, it was." The agent checked his license and handed it back.
"And where are you headed this morning?"
"We work at the wine farm up the valley away."
"Hey, I hope you've come after those goddamn vigilantes. They got everyone around here scared half to death.
And where have you been this morning?"
"We were at a party in Silver City last night. It went on kind of late. But I'm sober, don't worry."
"That's okay."
"Listen, I write paragraphs for the local paper, you know, the Silver City Chronicle. Could I get a quote from you about this raid? It's going to be the biggest news in Sierra County for years."
As the words came out of his mouth, he realized this was a risky pose for a man who could not read or write. He slapped his pockets.
Gee, I didn't even have a pencil.
We can't say anything, the agent said. You'll have to call the press person at the Sacramento office of the Bureau. He pretended disappointment.
Oh, sure, I understand.
You said you were headed home?
Yes. Okay, I guess we'll be on our way. Well, good luck with those vigilantes.
Thank you. The agents returned to their car. They didn't make a note of my name. Priest jumped back in his car. In his mirror, he watched the agents as they got into their car. Neither one appeared to write anything down.
Jesus Christ, he breathed gratefully. They bought my story.
He pulled away, and the Buick followed. As he approached the entrance to the Los Alamos spread a few minutes later, Priest rolled down his window, listening for gunfire. He heard none. It seemed the FBI had caught Los Alamos sleeping. He rounded a bend and saw two cars parked near the entrance to the place. The wooden five-bar gate that had blocked the track was smashed to splinters. He guessed the FBI had driven their armored trucks right through it without stopping. The gate was normally guarded. Where was the sentry? Then he saw a man in camouflage pants, face down on the grass, hands cuffed behind his back, guarded by four agents. The feds were taking no chances. The agents looked up alertly at the CUDA, then relaxed when they saw the green Buick following it. Priest drove slowly, like a curious passerby. Behind him, the Buick pulled over and stopped near the busted gate. As soon as he was out of sight, Priest stepped on the gas.
This book is continued on Disc 7. Disc 7.
Behind him, the Buick pulled over and stopped near the busted gate. As soon as he was out of sight, Priest stepped on the gas. When he got back to the commune, he went straight to Starr's cabin to tell her about the FBI. He found her in bed with Bones. He touched her shoulder to wake her, then said, "We need to talk. I'll wait outside." She nodded. Bones did not stir. Priest stepped outside while she got dressed. He had no objection to Starr renewing her relationship with Bones, of course. Priest was sleeping with Melanie regularly, and Starr had the right to amuse herself with an old flame. All the same, he felt a mixture of curiosity and apprehension. In bed together, were they passionate, hungry for each other, or relaxed and playful? Did Starr think of Priest while she was making love to Bones? Or did she put all other lovers out of her mind and think only of the one she was with? Did she compare them in her head and notice that one was more energetic or more tender or more skillful? These questions were not new. He recalled having the same thoughts whenever Starr had a lover. This was just like the early days, except that they were all so much older. He knew that his commune was not like others. Paul Beale followed the fortunes of other groups. They had all started with similar ideals, but most had compromised. They generally still worshipped together, following a guru or a religious discipline of some kind, but they had reverted to private property and the use of money and no longer practiced complete sexual freedom. They were weak, Priest figured. They had not had the strength of will to stick to their ideals and make them work. In self-satisfied moments, he told himself it was a question of leadership. Starr came out in her jeans and a baggy, bright blue sweatshirt. For someone who had just got up, she looked great. Priest told her so. "A good fuck does wonders for my complexion," she said. There was just enough of an edge in her voice to make Priest think that Bones was some kind of revenge for Melanie. Was this going to be a destabilizing factor? He already had too much to worry about. He put that thought aside for the moment. Walking to the cookhouse, he told Starr about the FBI raid on Los Alamos. "They may decide to check out the other residences in the valley, and if so, they'll probably find their way here. They won't be suspicious so long as we don't let them know we're a commune. We just have to maintain our usual pretense. If we're itinerant workers with no long-term interest in the valley, there's no reason we should care about the dam." She nodded.
You'd better remind everyone at breakfast. The rice-eaters will know what's really on your mind. The others will think it's just our normal policy of not saying anything that might attract attention. What about the children? They won't question kids. They're the FBI, not the Gestapo.
Okay.
They went into the cookhouse and started coffee. It was mid-morning when two agents stumbled down the hill with mud on their loafers and weeds clinging to the cuffs of their pants. Priest was watching from the barn. If he recognized anyone from yesterday, he planned to slip away through the cabins and disappear into the woods. But he had never seen these two before. The younger man was tall and broad, with a Nordic look, pale blonde hair and fair skin. The older was an Asian man with black hair thinning on top. They were not the two who had questioned him this morning, and he was sure neither had been at the press conference. Most of the adults were in the vineyard, spraying the vines with diluted hot sauce to keep the deer from eating the new shoots. The children were in the temple, having a Sunday school lesson from Star, who was telling them the story of Moses in the bulrushes. Despite the careful preparations he had made, Priest felt a stab of sheer terror as the agents approached. For 25 years this place had been a secret sanctuary. Until last Thursday, when a cop had come looking for the parents of Flower, no official had ever set foot here. No county surveyor, no mailman, not even a garbage collector. And here was the FBI. If he could have called down a bolt of lightning to strike the agents dead, he would have done it without a second thought. He took a deep breath, then walked across the slope of the hillside to the vineyard. Dale greeted the two agents as arranged. Priest filled a watering can with the pepper mixture and began to spray, moving toward Dale so that he could hear the conversation. The Asian man spoke in a friendly tone.
"We're FBI agents, making some routine inquiries in the neighborhood. I'm Bill Ho, and this is John Aldrich."
That was encouraging, Priest told himself. It sounded as though they had no special interest in the vineyard. They were just looking around, hoping to pick up clues. It was a fishing expedition. But the thought did not make him feel much less tense. He looked around appreciatively, taking in the valley.
"What a beautiful spot."
Dale nodded.
"We're very attached to it."
"Take care, Dale. Drop the heavy irony. This is not a frigging game."
Aldrich, the younger agent, said impatiently, "Are you in charge here?"
He had a southern accent.
"I'm the foreman," Dale said. "How can I help you?"
Ho said, "Do you folks live here?" Priest pretended to go on working, but his heart was thumping, and he strained to hear.
"Most of us are seasonal workers," Dale said, following the script agreed upon with Priest. "The company provides accommodation because this place is so far from anywhere."
Aldrich said, "Strange place for a fruit farm."
"It's not a fruit farm, it's a winery. Would you like to try a glass of last year's vintage? It's really very good."
"No thanks, unless you have an alcohol-free product."
"No, sorry, just the real thing."
"Who owns the place?"
"The Napa Bottling Company."
Aldrich made a note. Ho glanced toward the cluster of buildings on the far side of the vineyard.
"Mind if we take a look around?"
Dale shrugged.
"Sure, go ahead."
He resumed his work. Priest watched anxiously as the agents headed off. On the surface, it was a plausible story that these people were badly paid workers living in low-grade accommodation provided by a stingy management. But there were clues here that might make a smart agent ask more questions. The temple was the most obvious. Star had folded up the old banner bearing the 5 paradoxes of Bagram. All the same, someone with an inquiring mind might ask why the schoolroom was a round building with no windows and no furniture. Also, there were marijuana patches in the woods nearby. The FBI agents were not interested in small-time doping, but cultivation did not fit in with the fiction of a transient population. The free shop looked like any other shop until you noticed that there were no prices on anything and no cash register. There might be 100 other ways the pretense would fall apart under thorough investigation, but Priest was hoping the FBI was focused on Los Alamos and just checking out the neighbors as a matter of routine. He had to fight the temptation to follow the agents. He was desperate to see what they looked at and hear what they said to each other as they poked around his home, but he forced himself to keep spraying, glancing up from the vines every minute or two to see where they were and what they were doing. They went into the cookhouse. Garden and Slow were there, making lasagna for the midday meal. What were the agents saying to them? Was Garden chattering nervously and giving herself away? Had Slow forgotten his instructions and started to jabber enthusiastically about daily meditation? The agents emerged from the cookhouse. Priest looked hard at them, trying to guess their thoughts, but they were too far away for him to read their faces, and their body language gave nothing away. They began to wander around the cabins, peeking in. Priest could not guess whether anything they saw would make them suspect that this was anything more than a wine farm. They checked out the grape press, the barns where the wine was fermented, and the barrels of last year's vintage waiting to be bottled. Had they noticed that nothing was powered by electricity? They opened the door of the temple. Would they speak to the children, contrary to Priest's prediction? Would Star blow her cool and call them fascist pigs? Priest held his breath. The agents closed the door without going inside. They spoke to Oak Tree, who was cutting barrel staves in the yard. He looked up at them and answered curtly without stopping his work. Maybe he figured it would look suspicious if he was friendly. They came across Aneth hanging diapers out to dry. She refused to use disposable diapers. She was probably explaining this to the agents, saying there aren't enough trees in the world for every child to have disposable diapers. They walked down to the stream and studied the stones in the shallow brook, seeming to contemplate crossing. The marijuana patches were all on the far side, but the agents apparently did not want to get their feet wet, for they turned around and came back. At last they returned to the vineyard. Priest tried to study their faces without staring. Were they convinced, or had they seen something that made them suspicious? Aldrich seemed hostile, Ho friendly, but that could just be an act. Aldrich spoke to Dale. "Y'all have some of these cabins tricked out kind of nice for temporary accommodation, don't you?" Priest went cold. It was a skeptical question, suggesting that Aldrich did not buy their story. Priest began to wonder if there was any way he could kill both FBI men and get away with it. "Yeah," Dale said, "some of us come back year after year." He was improvising. None of this had been scripted. "And a few of us live here all year round." Dale was not a practiced liar. If this went on too long, he would give himself away. Aldrich said, "I want a list of everyone who lives or works here." Priest's mind raced. Dale could not use people's communal names, for that would give the game away, and anyway the agents would insist on real names. But some of the communards had police records, including Priest himself. Would Dale think fast enough to realize he had to invent names for everyone? Would he have the nerve to do it? Ho added, "We also need ages and permanent addresses." His tone was apologetic. "Shit, this is getting worse." Dale said, "You could get those from the company's records." "No, they couldn't." Ho said, "I'm sorry, we need them right now." Dale looked nonplussed. "Gee, I guess you'll have to go around asking them all. I sure as heck don't know everyone's birthday. I'm their boss, not their granddad." Priest's mind raced. This was dangerous. He could not allow the agents to question everyone. They would give themselves away a dozen times. He made a snap decision and stepped forward. "Mr. Arnold," he said, inventing a name for Dale on the spur of the moment, "maybe I could assist the gentleman." Without planning it, he had adopted the persona of a friendly dope, eager to help but not very bright. He addressed the agents. "I've been coming here a few years. I guess I know everybody and how old they are." Dale looked relieved to hand the responsibility back to Priest. "Okay, go ahead," he said. "Why don't you come to the cookhouse?" Priest said to the agents. "If you don't drink wine, I bet you'd like a cup of coffee." Ho smiled and said, "That'd be real good." Priest led them back through the rows of vines and took them into the cookhouse. "We got some paperwork to do," he explained to Garden and Slow. "You two take no notice of us. Just go on making that great-smelling pasta." He offered Priest his notebook. "Why don't you just write down the names, ages, and addresses right here?" Priest did not take the notebook. "Oh, my handwriting is the worst in the world," he said smoothly. "Now you sit yourselves down and write the names while I make you coffee." He put a pot of water on the fire, and the agent sat at the long pine table. "The foreman is Dale Arnold. He's 42. The These guys would never be able to check. No one here was in the phone book or on any kind of register.
Permanent address?
He lives here. Everyone does.
I thought you were seasonal workers.
That's right. Most of them will leave come November when the harvest is in and the grapes have been crushed, but they ain't the kind of folks who keep two homes. Why pay rent on a place when you're living somewhere else?
So the permanent address for everyone here would be?
Silver River Valley Winery, Silver City, California. But people have their mail sent to the company in Napa. It's safer.
Aldrich was looking irritated and slightly bemused, as Priest intended. Querulous people did not have the patience to pursue minor inconsistencies. He poured them coffee as he made up a list of names. To help him remember who was who, he used variations of their commune names. Dale Arnold, Peggy Starr, Richard Priestley, Holly Goldman. He left out Melanie and Dusty, as they were not there. Dusty was at his father's place, and Melanie had gone to fetch him. Aldrich interrupted him.
In my experience, most transient agricultural workers in this state are Mexican, or at least Hispanic.
Yeah, and this bunch is everything but, Priest agreed. The company has a few vineyards, and I guess the boss keeps the Hispanics all together in their own gangs with Spanish-speaking foremen and puts everyone else on our team. It ain't racism, you understand, just practical.
They seemed to accept that. Priest went slowly, dragging out the session as long as possible. The agents could do no harm in the cookhouse. If they got bored and became impatient to leave, so much the better. While he talked, Garden and Slow carried on cooking. Garden was silent and stone-faced and somehow managed to stir pots in a haughty manner. Slow was jumpy and kept darting terrified glances at the agent, but they did not seem to care. Maybe they were used to people being frightened of them. Maybe they liked it. Priest took 15 or 20 minutes to give them the names and ages of the commune's 26 adults. Ho was closing his notebook when Priest said,
"Now, the children, let me think, gee, they grow up so fast, don't they?"
Aldrich gave a grunt of exasperation.
"I don't think we need to know the children's names," he said.
"Okay," Priest said equably. "More coffee for you folks?"
"No, thanks."
Aldrich looked at Ho. "I think we're done here."
Ho said, "So this land is owned by the Napa Bottling Company?"
Priest saw a chance to cover up the slip Dale had made earlier.
No, that ain't exactly right," he said. "And the company operates the winery, but I believe the land is owned by the government."
"So the name on the lease would be Napa Bottling?" Priest hesitated. Ho, the friendly one, was asking the really dangerous questions. But how was he to reply? It was too risky to lie. They could check this in seconds. Reluctantly, he said,
"Matter of fact, I think the name on the lease may be Stella Higgins."
He hated to give Starr's real name to the FBI. "She was the woman who started the vineyard years ago." He hoped it would not be of any use to them. He could not see how it gave them any clues. Ho wrote down the name.
"That's all, I think."
Priest hid his relief.
"Well, good luck with the rest of your inquiries," he said as he led them out.
He took them through the vineyard. They stopped to thank Dale for his cooperation.
"Who are you guys after, anyway?" Dale said.
"A terrorist group that's trying to blackmail the governor of California," Ho told them.
"Well, I sure hope you catch them," Dale said sincerely.
"No, you don't." At last the two agents walked away across the field, stumbling occasionally on the uneven ground, and disappeared into the trees.
"Well, that seemed to go pretty well," Dale said to Priest, looking pleased with himself.
"Jesus Christ Almighty, if only you knew."
Chapter 12 Sunday afternoon, Judy took Beau to see the new Clint Eastwood movie at the Alexandria Cinema on the corner of Geary and 18th. To her surprise, she forgot about earthquakes for a couple of hours and had a good time. Afterward, they went for a sandwich and a beer at one of Beau's joints, a cop's pub with a TV over the bar and a sign on the door saying, "We cheat tourists." Beau finished his cheeseburger and took a swig of Guinness.
"Clint Eastwood should star in the story of my life," he said.
"Come on," Judy said. "Every detective in the world thinks that." Yeah, but I even look like Clint.
Judy grinned. Beau had a round face with a snub nose. She said, I like Mickey Rooney for the part.
I think people should be able to divorce their kids, Beau said, but he was laughing.
The news came on TV. When Judy saw footage of the raid on Los Alamos, she smiled sourly. Brian Kincaid had screamed at her for interfering. Then he had adopted her plan. However, there was no triumphal interview with Brian. There was film of a smashed five-bar gate, a sign that read, We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government, and a SWAT team in their flak jackets returning from the scene. Beau said, Looks to me like they didn't find anything. That puzzled Judy.
I'm surprised, she said. Los Alamos seemed like really hot suspects.
She was disappointed. It seemed her instinct had been completely wrong. The newscaster was saying that no arrests had been made.
They don't even say they seized evidence, Beau said. I wonder what the story is.
If you're about done here, we can go find out, Judy said. They left the bar and got into Judy's car. She picked up her car phone and called Simon Sparrow's home number.
What do you hear about the raid? She asked him.
We got zip.
That's what I thought.
There are no computers on the premises, so it's hard to imagine they could have left a message on the Internet. Nobody there even has a college degree, and I doubt if any one of them could spell seismologist. There are four women in the group, but none of them matches either of our two female profiles. These girls are in their late teens and early 20s. And the vigilantes have